You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, also online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Since the mid-19th century, the domestic authority for many British homemakers has been one Mrs. Beaton. Beaton's Book of Household Management was first published in the 1860s. Less than a decade later, millions of copies were in print. Mrs. Beaton, however, never knew the extent of her success. She died in 1865 at the age of 28. Now, thanks to biographer Catherine Hughes, we can get to know Mrs. Beaton. Catherine Hughes is the author of The Short Life and Long Times of Mrs. Beaton. In addition to being a biography of Isabella Mason Beaton, The Short Life and Long Times of Mrs. Beaton, the first domestic goddess, offers us a lens through which we can glimpse the Victorian age. After all, Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management offered more than help in the kitchen. It also offered all kinds of domestic information. For example, it could help you determine if you were well off enough to hire a footman. And Catherine Hughes has included in her story of Mrs. Beaton's life what she's called interludes and an imaginary consumer of Beaton's Book of Household Management. And here she provides us with details of life for the audience for Mrs. Beaton's book, people who were striving for economic and social advancement. The Short Life and Long Times of Mrs. Beaton, the First Domestic Goddess, is published by Knopf. Catherine Hughes, good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
I'm delighted, Celeste. Absolutely delighted.
Oh, I'm delighted to speak with you. This is a delightful book. I am so enjoying it.
That gives me enormous pleasure. I wasn't quite certain how it would go down in the States, because I know that you have, by and large, haven't heard of Mrs. Beaton.
Right. Never heard of her before.
I know, and to us here in Britain, you know, she's just a complete household name. She's a kind of Victorian Martha Stewart. So I was a bit worried when the book was published in the States, because I wasn't certain, you know, whether it would mean anything to anybody at all. Mm.
Why haven't we heard about Mrs. Beaton until now here in the States?
Well, I think it's because you had your own domestic goddesses. You know, you had Harriet Beecher Stowe and Catherine Beecher, her sister, who wrote brilliant domestic Bibles for a kind of pioneering generation of women. Later on, you know, you have people like Lydia Maria Child and so forth. So you had your own very, very good domestic writers who were talking to a very particular kind of American constituency, often talking to women who had to, you know, cross America in a wagon and so forth. And that wasn't the kind of person that Mrs. Beaton was talking to. She was talking to the sort of woman that lived in a well-established industrial city.
Yeah. And you say in your book that embedded in her text is the assumption that the household is an aspirational one, busy edging itself into a style of living that currently lies just outside their reach.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, in the 1850s, over here in Britain, we had this hugely expanding middle class, and people who really hadn't thought in those sort of terms before. I mean, they'd been too busy just getting by, you know, just putting food on the table. These people, for the very first time, were starting to think, well, I've got a little bit of surplus cash. How can I spend it? How do smart people do these things? And so Mrs. Beaton wrote a book telling you, really, you know, what to do if you wanted to kind of ape the people who were just a little bit above you, people whom you'd always looked up to but now felt that you'd like to have that sort of life too. You'd like to have a maid servant. You'd like to have, you know, a new carpet. You'd like to have a fancy new French meal for dinner. So she was kind of telling people, it was like a Bible, really, for social advancement.
Yeah, and thrift and elegance could go hand in hand.
Well, so she says. She's also very, yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, again, for a British audience, we tend to assume that Mrs. Beaton was terribly, terribly extravagant. But actually, if you go back to her original book, which, as you say, was published in 1861, it's actually very, very thrifty. It's got more in common with the American cookbooks, you know, ones which are all, and there's a lovely, lovely American cookbook called The Frugal Housewife. Well, in a sense, Mrs. Beaton was also a frugal housewife. I mean, she tells you, for instance, that if you have a nice big Sunday lunch, you can on Monday turn the roast into rissoles, and then on Tuesday you can turn it into stew, and then on Wednesday it's soup, and by Thursday it's stock. So it's very, very thrifty. There's no throwing away anything in this household.
Also, the household is a scientific one.
Well, that's right. I mean, Mrs. Beeson was living at a time of intense industrialization in Britain. So, you know, the factory culture was all around her. And for the first time, people were thinking about things like time and motion, efficiency studies, that sort of thing. And you could see how, you know, she'd read about this sort of thing going on in the great factories of the Northwest, in Liverpool and Manchester and so forth. And she thought, well, why not adopt some of that scientific management to the home? So what she does is she describes the small domestic home as if it were, you know, a factory that needed proper running. So she's always costing everything out in terms of time and money. For instance, she says in the winter, don't get up at 6 o'clock in the morning because it'll cost you so much extra in candles that it doesn't make sense. So instead you get up at 7 o'clock in the winter. So there's that real attention to detail. How can you run this little factory as efficiently as possible?
Staying in bed till 7 sounds nice in the wintertime.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I think for most of us, actually, I mean, certainly over here in Britain, we get up quite late, so we think 7 o'clock is actually quite early. But the idea that mostly in the summer you had to get up at 6 o'clock, says Mrs. Beeson.
Yeah. How does the book hold up?
Well, I mean, what happened was that right from the get-go, 5 years after it was published, her widower, Sam Beeson, who was a publisher, started updating it. And that's what happened. So every 10 years it would get updated so that by, I don't know, 1907, there wasn't much of the original Mrs. Beeson left. But it did mean, of course, that the book seemed very modern and fresh, so that each new generation rediscovered. They thought they were rediscovering Mrs. Beeton. What they were actually rediscovering was a sort of updated version of her. So I think that's probably the secret to her longevity in our culture. She's a bit like Coca-Cola or Nike in that her name remains the same, but the product is constantly tweaked.
Yeah.
I have to say, if you read the original book, 1861, it does seem terribly quaint, although I have to say some of the recipes are rather good. She gives a really gorgeous recipe for rice pudding that I honestly challenge you to beat it today. It's absolutely delicious.
Yeah. Can you give us some further sense of the recipes in the original?
Well, there's 2,000 recipes. And again, you know, here in Britain, we grew up with the idea that Mrs. Beeton actually wrote every single one of these recipes. That's what we think.
Yeah.
Mrs. Beeton was a fabulous cook. What I discovered when I was doing the research, and it took me about 5 or 6 years, was that Mrs. Beeton had done what actually a lot of cookery writers do. She had taken recipes from previous cookery writers and she tweaked them to make them better, more efficient, or, you know, more appropriate for a contemporary climate. So actually, out of all those 2,000 recipes, there's only one that I've actually identified as belonging to her and her alone. And it's rather grim. It's called Useful Soup for Benevolent Purposes, which doesn't sound cheery. And actually, the idea was that you knocked this up. It's 10 gallons worth of water and a couple of turnips and half a pound of salt. And you doled this out to any poor people who came to your back door during the winter. I have to say, I don't think it was very appetizing. And I should think the poor probably beat a hasty retreat and went to find something else to eat. But apart from that recipe, everything is, as I say, copied or tweaked. And there's some lovely, gorgeous stuff in there. I mean, very, very luxurious. Turtle soup, for instance, how to make a turtle soup. Although the first line of the recipe might put you off because it says, cut off the head of the turtle.
Yeah.
Which is not actually what, you know, doesn't fill one with joy.
No.
And there's an awful lot about how to serve up pig's trotters, and it often will say things like, cut the trotters off the pig first. Now, I'm sure people thought nothing of doing that in the mid-19th century, but to us, that might seem a bit gruesome.
Yeah. Well, in 2,000 recipes, and some of them quite sophisticated, many of them, were the Victorians foodies?
Well, that's really interesting. Again, food was used as a kind of status symbol for this group of people, which is this very large middle-class group of people. So they were terribly interested in the idea that food said something about you. And for that reason, they became obsessed with the idea that French food was particularly sophisticated. So what you'll get, certainly in later editions of Mrs. Beeton, is sort of quasi-French recipes which have actually got nothing to do with French food at all. So often, for instance, very sensible British dishes are given fancy French names just to make them sound more exciting. They were foodies, but in a sense they were also spending a lot of time just just actually making certain that the food that came to their table was healthy. In the mid-19th century in Britain, there was a lot of adulteration of food. A series of scandals when it emerged that milk, for instance, was routinely watered down before it came to the table, that bread was bulked out with things like acorns, that sweets were actually had white arsenic added to them. I mean, none of this sounds very healthy. Mm. And so mid-Victorians were actually spending a lot of time worrying about where the food on their table had actually come from, whether it was pure. And that's quite interesting because certainly in Britain, and I know over there too, we have a huge kind of interest at the moment in the purity of our food. We want to know where it's come from, whether it's safe, what the provenance is. And I find echoes of that a lot with the mid-Victorians too.
Yeah. And also I think in our day, the status thing is there as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah. In Britain it's all about giving a smart dinner party. And we have our iconic people like Nigella Lawson and Jamie Oliver, whom you may have heard of, who are these TV celebrity chefs who will show you how to kind of put on a fantastic spread. But the spread isn't just for you. It's quite clear. It's for your neighbours, and it's to impress your colleagues as well. And I think the Victorians had a lot of that as well. The kind of people that Mrs. Beeson was writing for would scrimp and save for the whole month so that they could put on a really, really good public display of consumption at the end of the month and invite everybody round just to see how well they were doing.
Mm. Speaking of status, how much money did one need before a footman could be hired?
You need an awful lot of money. Certainly the kinds of people that Mrs. Beeson was writing for really would never have managed to run to a footman. I mean, a footman was what you had if you were tremendously wealthy, probably if you were earning about £1,000 a year, which was a huge amount of money. That would mean you were a very, very successful society doctor or barrister. Certainly the kinds of people Mrs. Beeson was writing for, they liked to know who could afford a footman. They liked to read about these things, but they actually knew in their hearts that the most they were ever going to manage was probably one rather small 14-year-old girl who would come around and be a maid of all work.
Yeah. A maid of all work, that would be the first position.
That's absolutely the first position. It's as it says, it's the maid of all work.
Yeah.
You're 14, it's your first job, you're put into home, to go and work in a home, and you literally do everything that's required of you, and that could be looking after the children. It could be even, if it's a farming family, it could even mean helping with the dairy produce, making the butter. It means sweeping the floors. It means helping out with the cooking at night. I mean, it's a real kind of, it's a hugely laborious job.
Yeah.
And that really is the kind of help that most of Mrs. Beeton's readers could have expected.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Mrs. Beeton's readers, if they had that little bit of help, their lives were still pretty laborious.
Oh, absolutely, because, of course, I mean, stating the obvious, there were no no mod cons, as we call them. So water often there wasn't running water. There certainly wasn't any gas cookers at that time. Everything had to be done by hand. There were no vacuum cleaners. So it was immensely laborious. And that, I think, explains why the diet that Mrs. Beeton suggests for her readers is, to our way of thinking, so heavy in calories. I got a modern nutritionist to have a look at the diet, and she reckoned that it would be giving a woman perhaps 3,000 calories a day. Well, now, if you ate 3,000 calories a day today, you would be quite stout. You would be quite heavy by the end of it. But, of course, these women were doing so much physical labor in the home that clearly they needed that amount of fat and protein just to get them through the kind of work that today only construction workers do.
Hmm. Mod cons, that means modern...
Oh, sorry, it means modern conveniences.
Modern conveniences.
Sorry, that's our word for it, meaning, you know, dishwashers.
Right.
Washing machines,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, very good. There is a fascinating chapter in your book. Well, there are many, but the whole book is very, very good. But I love the chapter, The Alpha and the Omega.
Oh, yes.
And here we can give our listeners this afternoon a sense of the life of a woman who might have been reading Mrs. Beeton's book.
Right.
And you've created her for us readers, and it's very interesting. Tell us about this chapter, The Alpha and the Omega.
Sorry. Oh, well, what happened was that I was very keen. I wanted to find out what it actually felt like to be a young woman in 1861 and to read Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management. The problem is that that evidence just doesn't exist. I mean, I'm an historian. I work in archives all around the country, but nowhere really will you find evidence that suggests what it was actually like to read the book. It's very, very frustrating. And so I realized that the only thing I could do was actually create somebody. Now, by that I don't mean that I just, you know, took off into the realms of fantasy. I knew exactly what this girl would be like. I knew how much money her husband would earn. I had a sense of what her frustrations would be. And so what I really had to do was kind of put flesh on that data to create the kind of emotional experience of reading the book for the first time.
Yes, and you've created Mary.
That's right.
And her mother, Polly.
That's right.
And here we have, this is interesting too, kind of a clash of generations and class aspirations.
Absolutely. I mean, believe it or not, Polly and Mary are actually the same name, in the sense that Mary, who's this young girl who's keeping house for the first time, her mother is called Polly, but that's actually just the old country version of Mary. And I think that tells you a lot about kind of generation clash. So that Polly, Mary's mother, lives in the country. She's used to doing all her own housework. She's used to helping out in her husband's shop. She feels no shame at all at being seen serving behind the counter, for instance. It's a draper's shop. She feels absolutely no shame in doing all her own cookery and housework. And in the evening, she'll also help her husband with the bookkeeping. So this is a woman who's grown up in the first half of the 19th century. By contrast, her daughter, Mary, is a lot more aspirational. She doesn't want to work in a shop, certainly not. She'd be mortified if she thought her friends knew that even that her mother had worked in a shop. She wants to live the life of a kind of middle-class lady at home. And that involves really not doing anything very much. It involves painting a little bit, perhaps playing the piano, and going to make social calls on her neighbours. It also involves, of course, doing this awful ordeal once a month of holding a very, very smart dinner party.
Yeah. Well, whereas Polly always kept a good table, a party is very important to Mary. Would you read us something from this chapter, Catherine?
Yes, I will. I think I'll just read the bit about... this is Mary, who's pondering on the fact that her mother, Polly, whom she always thought was actually a rather sort of stick-in-the-mud, old-fashioned person, may well have had the right idea about everything, because Mary is beginning to realise that actually, if she'd bothered to watch her mother keeping house as a young girl, she might actually now have more of a store of domestic knowledge. She might not actually need to read Mrs. Beaton because she would already know these things. So I'm just going to read a paragraph. When Mary first saw the advertisement for the Book of Household Management, it immediately lodged in her mind. A new and practical work adapted for every family, and one that will save money every day and last a lifetime. Well, that sounded exactly what she needed. Mama had tried to teach her when she was young, but Mary would wriggle and sigh until she was told sharply to go out and play. She wishes now that she'd stayed to watch and learn. There's the matter of the accounts, for instance. Each year, Mama bought an account book from the stationers, one with neatly ruled columns and lines, in which you could write down everything you'd ordered from the butcher or fishmonger and the amount you had agreed to pay. When Mary was young, this figure work of Mama's had seemed natural, as much a part of the daily life as the bales of Belfast linen or the cards of Coventry ribbon that Papa sold every day in the shop. But by the time Mary was at school, this kind of account-keeping seemed, well, illiberal. Mary's quite certain that her friends' mothers didn't spend an hour every Saturday frowning and peering at rows of pencil marks. But now she's the mistress of her own household, Mary can sort of see the point. When the bills from the tradesmen come in at the end of the quarter, it really is vexing how they are always higher than she reckoned on. Asking her maid Harriet is no help, since she simply stares straight ahead like a foolish thing, and mutters that she really couldn't say whether the butcher sent chops on the 14th.
Poor Mary.
Sorry?
Poor Mary.
Poor Mary. Mary's obviously a woman who's realizing that actually she, all her aspirations to be a lady who doesn't do her own housework, are actually causing her more problems than she could ever have imagined when she was a restless little girl.
Yeah. The menu that you've set out for her in this part of the book is quite ambitious.
It's very ambitious, and it's actually taken straight from Mrs. Beeton. Shall I tell?
Yes, please.
Yes. Well, it's taken from Mrs. Beeton. It's Mrs. Beeton is very careful to lay out menu plans according to the seasons. So since this is February, Mary is obviously going to do Mrs. Beeton's bill of fare, that's menu, for six persons in February. And it is extraordinarily complicated. The first course is spring soup, that's probably spring vegetables, and boiled turbot and lobster sauce. Then the entrees, the main menu, the main course, is pork cutlets and oyster patties. The second course is, do bear in mind this is only for six people, the second course is boiled round of beef and marrow bones, roast chicken garnished with watercresses, and rolled bacon vegetables. The third course is cheesecakes, lemon cream, plum pudding, rhubarb tart.
Huh.
And then there's even a dessert menu after that where you have small sweetmeats, little kind of bon bouche, you know, little kind of sugary things. So that's a huge amount of, you know, food. And it's a huge amount of work for somebody. And I did work out that it would probably cost, oh, a very high proportion of the household's income for the month. But it was obviously terribly, terribly important that it should be laid on. It was a little bit of sort of domestic theatre.
Yeah.
It was it was something that showed, as it were, it turned the household into a public stage, and it showed everybody just how well the household was doing.
Yeah, it was dinner and entertainment. How long did a dinner like that go on?
Really the whole evening. Again, Polly, Mary's mother, would have probably had dinner at 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening. But Mary, who wants to be fashionable and smart, she'll start at about 7:30, and that is seen as rather decadent to start that late. And it will go on till about 10:30. And probably because she won't be able to afford, of course, a footman, somebody like that never could. What people in Mary's position often did, believe it or not, was that they hired the greengrocer to come round in the evening and pretend to be the footman for the evening. Greengrocers were particularly in demand, rather than, for instance, butchers, because being a greengrocer was a clean job. You were handling vegetables all day. You weren't handling meat. And so it was seen as a, you know, in the rank and hierarchy of tradespeople, it was seen as the most kind of polite of trades. And so the poor greengrocer would nip round once he'd shut up shop and would just pretend to be the footman for the evening. And if he recognised any of the guests, because they were customers in his shop, he simply wouldn't give any suggestion that he knew who they were.
Mm. Catherine Hughes is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of The Short Life and Long Times of Mrs. Beeton, the First Domestic Goddess. It is a biography. It is also social history. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. It strikes me that Mary Price and Mrs. Beeton, their situations were so different from one another. What would you like to tell us at a minimum about Isabella Beeton, who she was and what her station in life was?
Well, she actually didn't come from a very smart background at all. In a sense, her background was not dissimilar from Mary Price. Although her parents did eventually have money and died quite wealthy. They certainly weren't, when she was growing up, there wouldn't have been a lot of servants. And in fact, because she was the eldest daughter of 21 children,
right,
can you imagine?
Yeah.
That meant that she would have been pressed into service to do an awful lot of the work helping her mother. So I think she grew up actually not like Mary, in the sense that she probably did know how to do all these things because her mother jolly well made certain that she did. There simply wasn't any option.
Yeah, and maybe she could stay in bed till 7 or 8 once she got married.
Well, yes, absolutely. Although, in fact, I do know that both she and her husband were very, very early risers, so they tended to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
They were also very, very keen on hygiene, and she had one of the first baths with running water plumbed into her house.
Now, as a, when she was a newlywed when she began writing her book, would she have followed the recipes and the advice she provided for her readers?
Well, that's a big question. That's very, very interesting. Again, the sort of myth that we Brits all grew up with is the idea that Mrs. Beaton tested every single one of the 2,000 recipes and that she tried out all the practical advice. Well, I did my own little time and motion study, and I worked out that that simply wasn't possible. She would have to be cooking about 5 meals a day for 2 years to make that happen. So I think that she tried out some of the recipes, but if she copied something from a good source, a tried and tested source, I think it went straight into the book. I mean, the other interesting thing is that actually she, very unusually for a married woman, she worked. She helped her husband in the publishing business that he ran. So actually, all Mary Price's desires to be seen as an elegant lady who didn't work certainly weren't Isabella's desires at all. She was quite happy to get up, go on the train, go into London and help her husband work, as I say, producing women's magazines and books.
Yeah. What would her life, her working life, been like?
Well, we know that, as I say, that she actually got up early. Mm-hmm. She went on the commuter train, the businessman's train into London, and that was so unusual to have a lady going in on the 7 o'clock train that the other commuters, passengers, didn't like it at all, the men, because they felt, and I do find this slightly odd, but they felt that they couldn't smoke, that I sort of understand, but also the stories come down that they also felt that they couldn't swear because there was a lady present. Though, I mean, I wonder really how much swearing anybody's going to do at 7 o'clock in the morning. Anyway, she got into town. The business office was in the printing quarter near to the city of London. And she worked all day alongside her husband. She was an editor of the first modern women's magazine called the English Women's Domestic Magazine. So she was very, very busy commissioning people to write for it. She wrote the cookery copy for it herself. And then latterly, she and Sam, her husband, would go to Paris a few times a year to look at the fashions and get sketches done, which she would then bring back and translate into fashion advice for her British readers.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Catherine Hughes is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. And we have a listener waiting to talk with you, Catherine, now in Indiana on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi there.
I don't know in your research if you investigated the editions that were published in the United States or not, but during the 60s sometime, there was a paperback edition of her book. And it may have been prompted by Julia Child's of Art of French Cooking, which was very popular then.
Oh, that's very interesting. No, I didn't look at the U.S. editions because it was such a, just to look at the British manifestations of Mrs. Beaton would be enough. But that's very, very interesting. And you often find that Mrs. Beaton pops up exactly at the moment in a country's cultural history where cooking is very popular again. So I'm sure the point you make about Julia Child is probably absolutely right. Cookery was back in fashion in the 60s. Entertaining at home was back in fashion. I can absolutely see why it would then make publishing sense to produce a copy of Mrs. Beaton for the American market.
Well, that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Thank
You're
you.
You're welcome. Also, 1960, 1961, that would have been the centennial of...
That's exactly right. In 61, there was a huge centennial edition, and I suspect it's very likely that it found its way over to the States as well. But it wasn't the original Mrs. Beaton. It was a very updated one with all kinds of modern advice. And you find that happening right the way through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, certainly in this country. Mrs. Beaton, for instance, will be giving people advice on how to microwave. She'll be giving people advice on vegetarian cookery, which is certainly not something she was very interested in originally in 1861, Caribbean cookery. And indeed, you know, you can see in the late 19th century when a lot of British people went out to Australia, there will be Australian recipes seeping back into Mrs. Beaton. So there will be recipes for parrot pie, kangaroo stew, all sorts of delicious, slightly strange to us, but very, very delicious if you were a sort of pioneering woman going out to Australia for the first time.
Yeah. So how was it that British cookery got such a bad reputation?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, a lot of people blame Mrs. Beaton. I mean, you will find very, very well-known celebrity chefs over here blaming everything on Mrs. Beaton. I don't think that's quite fair, because what Mrs. Beaton did was that she made a kind of snapshot of where cookery was in Britain in 1861, because, you know, after all, she copied a lot of her recipes. She was kind of giving a picture of how things were. That isn't really the case. It isn't really the case that she actually was solo and personally responsible for producing overcooked vegetables, for instance. I think she provided a kind of snapshot, and then what happened is that, as always happens with cookery books, other people copied bits of her information, and so the 1861 cookery somehow became entrenched in the way that Britons thought about their food. I mean, certainly some of the stuff is slightly odd. She suggests that you should cook your carrots for 2 hours, and that means you get a very, very mushy mess, and Britons are very, very well known for very, very mushy vegetables. So I think perhaps we can blame Mrs. Beaton a little bit for that. But I don't think we can blame her for everything. I think, you know, it's a much, much bigger story than that.
Yeah, yeah. What sources did she draw on for that?
Well, I mean, she was absolutely brazen. She drew on sources that went right back to the 1680s, we believe. So, you know, there are cookery books by writers who are telling you things like, oh, I don't know, who are writing in the wake of Charles II, the Stuart monarchy. And she won't use the bits of information that will date her sources too much, but she will take things. She will tell you how to make the kind of very elaborate sugary desserts that were very popular in the 17th century, but really don't have much point in the mid-19th century. Then a little bit later on, she'll take sources from the 18th century, which are often very, very religiously inflected, because in the 18th century in Britain we had a sort of religious revival, and there were a lot of household books were published which sort of brought God and cookery together. Well, she'll take that kind of material and she'll plonk it down in the middle of her book, and it can read slightly oddly, because elsewhere Mrs. Beaton doesn't seem terribly interested in religion. So you will get these funny little kind of bits of patchwork. And that's what the book really is. It's a sort of vast patchwork made up of all the cookery and household writing of the previous 200 years. Yeah. So it's a very uneven book.
Well, apparently she did seek out advice from people who knew what they were doing in terms of cookery and running a household. There is one of the epigraphs at the outset of the book is from a note, a very curt one at that, from Henrietta English, and it, Newmarket, 21 July 1857. My dear Mrs. Beaton, I see difficulties in your way as regards publishing a book on cookery. Cookery is a science that is only learnt by long experience and years of study, which, of course, you have not had. Yours, V. Sincerely, Henrietta English.
That's right. That must be one of the most damning letters, I think, in culinary history. It's very interesting. Nobody knew for who Mrs. English was, and I actually managed to track her down. And I found out that she was an old friend of the Beaton families, so Isabella was really just writing to, as it were, a sort of auntie figure. But I also found out that Henrietta English, despite her surname, was actually French. And she had worked as a cook and a housekeeper in some very, very tony British households, because, you know, amongst the aristocracy, it was very smart to have a French cook. So Mrs. English, Henrietta English, was used, you know, she had spent 30 years in the best kinds of households. She knew all about what went on in the kitchens of dukes and viscounts. And so when this little upstart, Isabella Beaton, you know, a little young girl of 21, writes and says, I think I would like to write a cookery book, you can sort of see why the very middle-aged Mrs. English was absolutely appalled and hence wrote back this very, very curt note to her young friend.
Yeah. Tell us more about her husband, Sam, and their marriage.
Well, they married when they were young, as Victorians tended to. She was 19, he was 24. I think it was very much a love match. Her parents, it has to be said, really didn't approve of him at all. He was a very successful young man. He was the first British publisher to produce a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin in Britain, and he made a huge fortune out of Mrs. Beecher Stowe's classic. Mrs. Beecher Stowe was rather cross about this because she didn't get any royalties from British publications, and so Sam made a long dash over to meet Mrs. Beecher Stowe and try and talk her around, gave her some money, and tried to make her a friend, as it were, of his publishing house. And this he actually managed to do. So Mrs. Beecher Stowe was actually always very, very supportive of Sam and Isabella's work. But after the success of Uncle Tom's Cabin, Sam Beeton lost most of his money actually on publishing the sequel to Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was not Dread, which is, I think, most people think, but actually a rather sort of dreary book called The Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, which Mrs. Beecher Stowe produced, which really bombed both in Britain and the States. So when Sam married Isabella, they really didn't have very much money, and that explains why Isabella started helping Sam out in the business. The reason she first starts writing cookery copy for her husband's magazine, the Englishwoman's Domestic Magazine, is quite simple. It saves money. If Isabella writes the copy, it means that Sam won't have to pay a freelance cookery writer. So actually, oddly, it was the very fact that Sam wasn't doing very well financially that's responsible for Isabella Beeton first writing cookery copy. And it was because she'd written 3 or 4 months' worth of copy for the Englishwoman's Domestic Magazine that she and Sam got the idea that actually, why not do a whole book like this? Why not gather together all the recipes that she's collecting for the magazine, add in some household tips, and there's lots of household tips in the Book of Household Management. It tells you everything from what to do when your baby has a chesty cough to how to mend your wedding china. Why not, as it were, pool all that rich store of information and put it into a book? So the Book of Household Management is very much a sort of dual project. It's Sam's and Isabella's book.
Yeah. I wonder if, because of your book, if we would be seeing a reproduction of the original Beeton's Book of Household Management.
Well, that would be absolutely lovely. I mean, that would be so nice. I mean, certainly here in Britain, there is a very lovely, handsome facsimile edition, which is very beautiful. And it would be so nice if it was brought out in the States, because, of course, what I haven't said is that it was beautifully illustrated, the book. It used some of the first colour printing, and the pictures of the food are absolutely delicious. I mean, they're absolutely beautiful. They're works of art. And so it's actually a very kind of beautiful object to own in itself.
Mm. There were so many manifestations of Beeton's Book of Household Management that came along over time that she, as you alluded to earlier, became a brand. And with the passage of time, because there were so many of these books, people thought she was a fictional character.
That's absolutely right. I mean, people thought she was Betty Crocker, in effect. So in the 1930s, when her son presented the National Portrait Gallery with a photograph of her, people were absolutely staggered. There was an outcry in the national press because everybody had just assumed that Mrs. Beeton was a made-up brand, a Betty Crocker, somebody who had been kind of constructed simply in order to sell products, as it were. So people were absolutely shocked. Of course, they were also very surprised to learn that the woman whom they had always, if they thought she was a real person, they imagined that she must be a woman of at least 50 or 60, somebody who had spent their lifetime in a kitchen. So when they found out that she was actually a 21-year-old girl who'd written the book, They were absolutely, you know, amazed. And that's when people started getting kind of interested again in Mrs. Beeson in the 1930s, when they suddenly realized that not only was she a real person, but she was actually a person who was very, very different from the kind of old dragon whom they'd imagined.
And someone imagined her as a tub-like lady in black, which is the first chapter of your book.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of people thought that she was a bit like our Queen Victoria, that she was a tiny little lady, probably as round as she was tall, and, you know, very, very, probably more like Henrietta English, you know, very, very likely to tell you off for not doing things properly. And, of course, nothing could be further than the truth. She was a 21-year-old girl who was muddling through. She was much more like the fictional Mary Price. She was somebody who was kind of just trying to kind of get through to the end of the day and hoping that they were doing it all right.
Yeah. Tell us about the research that you did for this project.
Well, it was five years research, and there had never been a proper biography of Mrs. Beeson in Britain, and which is absolutely staggering given that she's such an important person to us. I soon discovered why. Her family, her direct descendants, had not wanted a biography published because there were certain things in the story of the marriage that were deeply, deeply upsetting. Mm-hmm. It looks, for instance, as though Sam may well have given Isabella syphilis, which is a horrible, horrible disease that means that you can't hang on to your pregnancies, so that you have a run of miscarriages and a run of sickly babies. Now, that sort of thing just seems terribly sad to us, but of course, to the Victorians and to people in the first half of the 20th century, it wasn't just sad, it was absolutely disgraceful. And so I can absolutely see why the family never wanted a biography written, and they kept all the sources to themselves. What happened was the last descendant died in 1999. That was the great-grandson. And all the material then became much more available. And it was possible, really, for the first time ever, to write a book about Mrs. Beeson that told the whole story, that didn't, after all, didn't dwell on the kind of sad side, because that would be misleading, but actually included that into a kind of much more complex picture about Victorian society and about the fact that Mrs. Beeson was producing a book that tried to speak to a new kind of mid-Victorian consumer.
Mm. Working on this project, did you find yourself talking to Mrs. Beeson?
Oh, goodness, yes, absolutely. I mean, it got to the extent, the point where I wasn't actually able to see the sources because they were in private hands still. And so I realized the only way I was going to get to see those sources was if I bought them myself. So what I did was I remortgaged my flat to raise the money to buy all the material. So I'm now the proud possessor of all the love letters between Sam and Isabella Beeson. And I can't tell you what an amazing feeling that is. It's every historian's dream, really, to own and to have that access to the voice of the past.
Yeah. If you could, and perhaps you've done this already, have you imagined getting together with a historical figure like Mrs. Beeson and perhaps some others and sitting down and enjoying a menu that Mrs. Beeson might have recommended?
I would absolutely love that. I can't tell you. My previous biography was of that brilliant Victorian novelist George Eliot, and I often have a slightly odd historian's fantasy of having a dinner party and having both Mrs. Beeson and George Eliot, who are roughly contemporaries but who certainly never met, and just wondering what would happen if we all sat down together and, you know, ate turtle soup and pig's trotters together.
Oh, I'd like an invitation, please.
You can have one, Celeste. You can have one.
Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. The book is a delight. It's also been very delightful talking with you, Catherine.
Thank you so much, Celeste. It's been so much fun.
Catherine Hughes has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author, most recently, of The Short Life and Long Times of Mrs. Beeson, the First Domestic Goddess. The book is published by Knopf.